I am in the home of Dr. Alfonso Roberti, a Harford County living treasure. Dr. Roberti was born in West Virginia, but has lived in Harford County for over 49 years and was the Harford County Superintendent of Schools for 18 years. He will describe some of the major events in his life and in Harford County, Maryland. Dr. Roberti, tell us where and when you were born.
I was born in a small town, coal mine town as a matter of fact, in West Virginia. The name of the town was Mannington. Mannington is a town that was very prosperous in the early part of the century. There was significant amounts of coal in the area, as well as oil and natural gas. But that was all depleted over a period of time, and as I was growing up, there wasn't much there except people who traveled to coal mines.
Well, what brought you to Harford County?
I came to Harford County for a teaching job that was offered to me by a former principal of the school that I began teaching in. That was Cambridge High School in Cambridge, Maryland. A gentleman by the name of Willard Hawkins, who was very well known in educational circles in Maryland, was the principal of Belair High School. He met me at the teachers' convention in 1951, early part of 1951, offered me a job, and the job entailed moving to Bel Air, but more than anything, it involved an $800 salary increase. I was making $2,200 a year at Cambridge High School, and Mr. Hawkins offered me $3,000 if I came to this brand new, highly regarded school in Bel Air, and I did, and that was where I began my work in Harford County.
Was that a lot of money back then, or how would that amount of money back at that time fit into the economic structure?
It was one heck of a lot of money as far as I was concerned. I was really struggling my first year, had no furniture, lived in a furnished apartment, and at the time $800 was significant, and I recall very vividly my wife was hoping that somehow we could find some money to buy a Singer sewing machine. And when I came to Bel Air, the first thing I thought of was buying her a Singer sewing machine so she could sew for dresses and things like that. So it was in those days, in 1951, a significant amount of money.
When you came to Harford County, where did you live?
I lived on Hickory Avenue, right in Bel Air, on Route 1 as you leave Bel Air. As a matter of fact, I recall the number, it was 707 Hickory Avenue. It was a $75 a month unfurnished apartment that was cold most of the time because the landlord wouldn't heat the place. But we struggled through and eventually got a few pieces of furniture on credit at Sears Roebuck, and were able to begin anew here in Harford County.
When you came into the county at that time period, what was the county like?
The county was a very lovely, semi-rural, rolling hills type of environment. It was beautiful, and we were delighted to come. Cambridge, Maryland was, of course, a very nice town, but it was larger, and it had a lot of significant problems. Bel Air and Harford County was just second heaven, really, and it was beautiful.
Tell us a little bit about your family, your mother and father and your siblings.
My mother and father were both born in Italy. My mother came over as an infant in the arms of her mother, and my father came when he was 18 years of age. And after working in some shoe factories, he bought a shoe repair shop in Mannington, West Virginia. Opened up the repair shop, ultimately met my mother, and was married. I have three brothers and a sister. Unfortunately, one of my brothers, my youngest one, died in the recent 12 months. But we lived in this little town, as my father was in those days sometimes referred to as a shoe cobbler.
Good. Tell us about your childhood.
My childhood was not very eventful. As I know what childhood's like these days in the Harford County environment, I was a youngster interested in going to school. Our school system was not very active. The teachers were laid back, and the curriculum wasn't strong. And I was able to coast by because my father, who was well known in the community at this time, had a good reputation, and as far as teachers were concerned, those Roberti kids were pretty nice kids. Mm-hmm. So we got along pretty good. But as I grew up, my father had a shoe shine stand in the shoe repair shop. I shined shoes and enjoyed the tips that came along with that job. I also learned to repair shoes. My dad insisted that we learn to work with our hands, and did a little of that, as well as being a newspaper boy. And ultimately, in my early years, about age of 14 and 15, I helped to operate a newsstand. I delivered papers early in the morning, came back, and opened up the newsstand and sold magazines, candy, and newspapers.
Well, you were very busy, obviously, weren't you?
Well, it was a nice time of life. You stayed busy. You made a little money, like $2.50 a week. And that money was pretty nice, especially when my dad, who had five children and was a shoe cobbler, didn't make an awful lot of money. So it was somewhat helpful to have a little change in your pocket as you continue to go to school and be a member of the community.
Well, you've already described quite a bit of difference between being a child today and being a child when you grew up. Do you see any other differences too?
There are significant differences, I must admit. Now, my background, of course, is such that I lived in an environment where there wasn't a lot of wealth. There was one wealthy person in this town, and he was a millionaire. In this day and age, a millionaire is just like nothing at all. You're a multimillionaire today if you have any significant amount of money. But anyhow, in my home community, most people were less than middle income style people. And we didn't have a whole lot to go on. Now, in this environment in Harford County, there are certainly a lot of young people that, while some of them work and make some money, many of them own their own cars. Well, I never owned a car until I got my first job. And the children have different behavior patterns these days in this community compared to what I observed in my own community. Children are much more aggressive, active, and involved than were children in my time in a little town in West Virginia.
Imagine. Well, you talked a little bit about your school, that you said the teachers were a little more laid back curriculum. What was a school day like for you at that point?
School day was not awfully exciting. I walked to school. I went to the same school that my mother attended. The building was built in the latter part of the 1800s. It was rather archaic. I didn't have an opportunity to take any of the advanced math or advanced science courses. The library was poorly stocked. It's quite different in a coal mining town or a West Virginia town, at least those in 1940. They may be much better today, but I doubt very much. My school day wasn't very long. There weren't significant after-school activities. If you were a football player, you were a success in West Virginia. That's mm-hmm. the case today. Mm-hmm. But nothing else really counted. I belonged to one club. It was called the High Y Club when I was in high school, and I was able to participate in minstrel shows. I learned how to play a clarinet. I played in the band. But aside from that, there wasn't much that you could count on as being comparable to what they offer today in schools in Harford County.
Big difference.
Yes, there is. Quite a bit, big difference.
Well, you know, at that particular time in your life, too, how did you decide what you thought you might do for a career?
Well, Uncle Sam knocked at my door the day after I graduated from high school, and that was May 30th. And August the 19th, I was drafted into the United States Army. I started out because I knew I was going to be drafted to go to the Marine Corps. I wanted to be a United States Marine, but I found out that I failed the examination because my left eye wasn't too good. But nonetheless, I got drafted and went to the Army and was over in Europe most of the time. During that time, and after the war was over in Europe, we were scheduled to go to Japan because that war was still about. And one of the highlights of my career in the Army was the day they told us the war in Japan was over and I wouldn't have to go. I was not a very good soldier. I wasn't trained very well because I was only 18 years old. And in less than, about 15 weeks, I was at the front lines in Germany. And I was scared most of the time. So the Army taught me one thing, and that is to look at myself and decide what I wanted to do. I could have stayed in the Army, or I could have gone on to something else, which I did.
Well, some of the jobs you mentioned before that you had when you were growing up, once you came out of the Army, did you start right into teaching then?
I went. When I came out of the Army, there was a thing known as the GI Bill of Rights, where the United States government paid veterans a stipend. And it was $75 a month, plus your college tuition if you went to college. I decided early on, because of the encouragement of my father and mother, to go to college. And at the time I thought, well, I don't know what I want to do precisely at this juncture, so I'll take a pre-engineering course. And that I did. And ultimately thought, well, I'll go into architecture. Well, that didn't turn out very well because, again, I had an eyesight problem. So I took my math courses and decided I'd be a math science teacher, and the GI Bill of Rights saw me through on that program, and when I graduated from college, I applied to every county in Maryland as well as every county in Florida to become a teacher, and Dorchester County responded promptly, and I went to Cambridge to teach.
Was there anything in your college experience or anything that you had seen that just said that, you know, you thought teaching would be the thing that you wanted to do?
The thing that encouraged me was observing good teachers both in the Army and in college. I saw outstanding work, and as I reflect on it a little more, I saw a couple of teachers in my childhood that were outstanding, and observing others in the profession made me think that would be the way to go. Unfortunately, jobs were rather plentiful, and the idea of the security and the benefits was something that attracted me, and it was a way to get started early in life, and I pursued it with diligence.
Much so. Now I want to talk to you a little bit more about your time in the Army and serving in Europe in World War II. You were drafted into the service. Now, what year was that, Dr. Lee?
1944.
So the war was still going?
Yes.
Going on very strongly. Mm-hmm. And what was it like at that particular point to serve in the Army?
I mentioned earlier that I delivered papers and worked in a newsstand for a lady that owned the newsstand. I remember on December the 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor, she called the Roberti boys, who were newspaper boys. Two of my three brothers were also into the delivering of papers. Anyhow, I remember that Sunday evening standing on the streets in this little town of Maine where no one really cared about international affairs, selling newspapers and shouting about the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. Well, at the time I thought, well, I'll sell these newspapers and make another small fortune, which I did, and that was really a small fortune. Never did I think that the war would be so prolonged that I would be drafted and be involved with it. Anyhow, I was, and after about 14 weeks of training in South Carolina, they shipped me over to France, and I joined as a replacement. I joined my infantry regiment, 14th Infantry Regiment, at Alsace-Lorraine, which is in eastern France, at the Siegfried Line. And I remember on this one Easter Sunday, I was buried into a foxhole, and the most pleasurable time of my early Army career was seeing hundreds of bombers flying over, heading for Germany to precede our movement across the Rhine River. It was quite a sight, and I'll never forget it. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I wasn't a delightful soldier. I behaved, and I did what I was supposed to do, but I was scared to death most of the time. And my regiment cleaned up south of the Battle of the Bulge, which was a big incident back then. We were with General Patton's army, and we were below the Battle of the Bulge, and our job was to clean up all that territory, and that meant walking on foot clear across Germany over to Austria, which is where we ended up at the end of the war. It was quite a long walk.
I can imagine. I can imagine. When you look back at that time period in your life, I know you mentioned something just a moment ago, but what stands out in your mind about your experience in the war at that time?
Well, I think the biggest thing was the way, as the war was approaching its end, the way the German soldier, whom I admired, generally speaking, just was so happy to have the war end and not be killed. You know, at that time there was not any thought of an atomic bomb or a hydrogen bomb. We were just hand-to-hand, bullet-to-bullet kind of fighting. So the thing that impressed me most as we rounded up thousands of prisoners, war prisoners, was the way they were so gracious and glad. It's a terribly important society that I certainly admired, and having the opportunity to be around these prisoners as the war was coming to an end was a significant event. Now, there were many other events that I witnessed that I wasn't too proud of, but this one really impressed me most. The others are warlike events that are pretty sad.
Did you find that when you got back to America, you had any difficulty adjusting back to civilian life, or?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, after the war ended, we became, my unit became a part of the military government. We would go to a town, and one of the towns we were in was called Würzburg in Germany, and our company commander became the mayor, and all of us were given other assignments, and it was through those assignments that I finally broke the pattern of being a buck private in the infantry, and through promotions I became a staff sergeant. To me, it was an achievement that I never dreamed of as just a fresh out of high school little boy. To get to become a staff sergeant in the Army was pretty significant. And the way I got it was that, believe it or not, in high school I took a typing class, and I was a typist. And after the war, they took my gun and gave me a typewriter and said, "Now you're going to type." And I said, "Fine." And that's the way I got to be a corporal and then a sergeant and then a staff sergeant. And then I got out of the Army, came home, and was discharged on Independence Day, believe it or not, July the 4th. And things were different back home. But my dad and mother and my two brothers that were in the service also were discharged. And it was, again, a disappointment to go back to this one-horse town and be confronted with the notion that you better make up your mind what you're going to do. My father insisted. And because he didn't have education, he was a strong advocate for it. And so he saw all of us go to college. And believe it or not, there are four boys and one sister, daughter, and all of us became teachers. And right near our home in Fairmont, West Virginia, was Fairmont State Normal School, then called Fairmont State Teachers College, that was later called Fairmont State College, just like Towson. Mm-hmm. Towson Normal, Towson State Teachers. Okay. And it has not yet become a university like Towson, but nonetheless, we all went to Fairmont State College and all of us became teachers. And that sort of says something about what my father thought of getting an education and becoming a teacher. In Italy, if you were a teacher, you were somebody. Well, we're going to be somebody in America.
That's very interesting. Well, tell us how you met your wife.
My wife was in high school. She's about 6 years younger than I am. And I was doing my practice teaching in Mannington High School in math, mainly math. And I saw this pretty girl go by one day as a part of the high school band front. And I finally contacted her, and she was always interested in eating hot dogs. And so I found out about that and bought her a hot dog and started our conversation. And from that day on, we kept right on going.
She still eating those hot dogs?
No, she wouldn't eat a hot dog and beg it. But we got married, and when I got out of college, we got married. Well, it was really when I knew I was getting out, we got married in February the 9th. And I was looking for a job, and she and I camped at my father's home, and she wrote my hundreds of letters seeking a teaching job on the typewriter. She was my personal secretary. Mm-hmm. So we got married and onward to Cambridge, Maryland.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your daughters, too.
My daughters are 2 years apart. They were born in 54 and 56, and fortunately for us, thankful to the good Lord, they got good health. They too both became teachers, because Dad was superintendent of schools during most of, well, he was assistant superintendent and superintendent of school during most of their time. And back then, you either went into nursing or teaching, and very few young ladies got into the professions outside of those two. And they went into teaching and have become teachers, and now looking forward to retiring from teaching. And as far as I know, and based on what I hear, they're both excellent teachers.
Good. Well, you came to Harford County, as you said, in 1951 to teach at Bel Air High School. What was it like being a teacher at Bel Air High School in 1951?
I taught chemistry, physics, and a course called related science to youngsters who had no intentions of going to college, but they were training to get involved with auto mechanics. And I, in conjunction with the auto shop teacher and some of the other teachers, coordinated a related science program. But my fondest part of all of that, even though I enjoyed teaching those young people as well, they were just so delightful. And they were disciplinary problems from time to time, but many of them I see in the community today, and they're contributing members. Some of them are deputy sheriffs, some of them are bus contractors, some of them own gas stations, and are contributing members of our society, though they didn't go to college. But my real interest was in teaching physics and chemistry to the college band. And these were young people that knew what they had ahead of them and were not a problem at all. They enjoyed the class, they came frequently with a smile on their face, and it was one of the happiest times of my life. As a matter of fact, it was such a thrilling experience that at Bel Air High School in 1956, my last year of teaching, they honored me by dedicating the yearbook in my behalf, and that class has had me back for every reunion they've had, and this July they'll have another one, their 46th or something like that. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. Children were much better behaved. Of course, we didn't have drugs, but we had cigarettes, and we had alcohol and beer. But those children were under the control of their parents by and large. There were some that escaped. But generally speaking, the parents were supportive, cooperative, and dedicated to the notion that those kids must succeed, because they were due to be on their own in due time. And it was just a delightful time of my life. And if you think about it now, I taught in 50-51 in Cambridge, and I taught for about 5 more years in Harford County. My daughters keep saying to me, "Dad, I've taught longer than you. I know what it's all about." And they're right.
How do you, when they tell you about their experiences with teaching, what comparisons would you draw?
Unfortunately, they're not very happy with the status of the situation right now. Children are much more assertive, much more all reacting to adult behavior, challenging authority, defying authority. They seem not to want to behave as well as those children that I taught. And from my own vantage point, I sense too, as I read the news articles and as I talk with other folks, I'm convinced that no longer do parents become a vital partner in the education of children. They stand off, let the children do as they will. The affluent society has created many, many problems with young people. Children have a lot of money. They can buy drugs. They can buy $3 a pack cigarettes. And they have cars and other kinds of satisfactory or unsatisfactory features that are available to them that were not available to young people in the 50s. And I like the period of time in the 50s when children were under the control of their parents and were more apt to behave. And, of course, we had the cigarette problem, and we had children that wanted to all go out to their cars and stuff like that, but we had a loyal faculty that closed ranks under the leadership of a good principal, and things were well organized.
So society's changes, you see it impacting education a lot today?
Very, very definitely.
Well, I want to ask you some more questions along those lines of education, since you have spent your career, a good bit of your life in education,
sure,
really.
I did.
I know you mentioned before that you had come into Harford County, you started out as a teacher, but eventually you got into administration. Could you just tell us a little bit about some of that?
Well, I was fortunate enough early while a teacher to get a part-time job as director of adult education that paid me $50 a month for the 10-month period. Adult education classes were scheduled throughout Bel Air, throughout Harford County at the various high schools, and it was my job to administer that program and to supervise it. And along the way, I think I impressed the superintendent of schools with my reporting and dedication, and as a result of that, Dr. Willis picked me up one day and said, "You're going to be our supervisor of purchasing." And he said, "But you can't leave your classroom until we find a suitable replacement." That time, science teachers were hard to find. Anyhow, they found one eventually. It was Daniel Tauber, and they took me up to the office, and I recall very vividly they had three bushel baskets full of bills, invoices, and statements. And Dr. Willis said, "Now, do you know why we got you up here? Those bills need to be paid." And they'd get around to paying their bills about every 6 months, and we had the worst reputation in the world. Well, I cleaned up that mess and reestablished our credibility with the vendors. As a result of that, he promoted me one more time to become business manager. He said, "Well, you're more than just a purchasing man." And so we hired a purchasing person, and I became the overseer of the business operation. And it wasn't long after that that he said, I think I want you to do a little bit more, and he said, "I am going to make you an assistant superintendent." So through Dr. Willis's efforts, I became assistant superintendent of schools and stayed with that position about 8 years, I think, and ultimately applied for the superintendency when he retired.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about Dr. Willis, because he was superintendent of schools for a number of years here in the county also.
25 years.
25 years. So that would put him back in the 40s through the most of the 50s, I guess.
Right, right.
And what do you remember about Dr. Willis that stands out in your mind?
I remember most his skill in dealing with the elected officials. In his day, it was county commissioners, three of them. He was able to deal, as I observed him, because I was his right-hand man most of the time. I prepared the budgets, and he had a very definite skill in dealing with them because he had a quick mind and could deal with financial issues on the spot. And they admired him for it, and of course, he was a very tough-headed go-getter. I mean, he picked up a school system in 48. That was loaded with one- and two-room schools, segregation, black, white. And he was able to build Bel Air High School, North Harford High School, Edgewood High School, Aberdeen High School, I think that's about it, and several elementary schools. And he had to live through the segregated period, and he had to live through the integration period, which was no easy task. But he was a real stalwart, a person I had admired, and one that taught me practically everything I know about being a decent, good school administrator.
Yes. Well, that's quite an endorsement, Dr. Wells.
Yes, it
really is. Well, in 1970, you were then appointed as the Harford County Superintendent of Schools, and you held that position for 18 years.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the system was like when you took it over? And
I had inherited a system that was ongoing and in good shape, except for one matter, and that was facilities. We didn't have adequate educational facilities because we were just growing. I think when Dr. Willis took over, the population was about 12,000. When he left, it was in the realm of 25,000. And in my time, we got up to...
You're talking about the student population?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
In my time, we got up to about 35, 36,000. And then we started a slight decline. But the thing that I had most to do was to find money to build school facilities. And I accomplished a lot of that over the 18 years, spent an awful lot of money and an awful lot of time getting it done. And even when I got most of it done and we went into this period of decline, there was still some unfinished business, old schools that needed to be rehabilitated, did some of that too. But the biggest problem I faced at the time was dealing with the need for adequate educational facilities. The curriculum was in good stead, good shape. The staff at school level and otherwise was doing a good job. And we were known throughout the state as a good quality school system. And kept up the good work. But a secondary problem was affiliated with this facility problem. That was getting enough money to pay decent salaries for teachers and to have money to maintain the facilities and to get adequate instructional materials. We always needed books, we always needed library books, we always needed maps and globes, and people couldn't understand why you needed maps and globes. Well, the world was changing, and we needed lumber, and we needed stuff for industrial arts back then. It was ongoing. So, my second problem after recognizing the problem with facilities was to get money. I spent most of my life in the field of education, struggling to get an adequate salary for teachers. Unfortunately, we never got enough money to do a heck of a lot of good. We put high emphasis on teacher salaries. But when Dr. Willis left as superintendent, he said, "Al, I worked real hard. And when I came into the system, when Milton Wright retired, we were 18th in cost per pupil." He said, "I'm leaving today and we're 18th. I said, "Well, Dr. Willis, I'm going to try to do better. I'll work just like you taught me." Well, we went up a time or two, but when I left, we were 18th. And right now, the system is 18th in cost per pupil. As a matter of fact, I think they've fallen to maybe 23rd or 24th. And to tell people money will solve problems is difficult for them to accept. They look at you and say, "No, money's not the answer. The answer is better teachers." And, you know, of course, I'd say, "And more teachers." And they'd say, "Yeah." I said, "Well, that takes money." So, the money situation in Harford County was the most difficult problem I faced. And I did my doctoral dissertation on the wealth of Harford County, and I analyzed statistics to determine whether Harford was making a reasonable effort to support education. And after all this thorough study and a dissertation that was at least 2.5 inches thick, my conclusion was that Harford was making a substantial effort to fund education. And that wasn't the finding that I wanted. I wanted the other side of that.
Isn't that interesting? Very interesting. Well, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced during your time as superintendent of schools?
Well, we tried to recruit the best we could get teachers. And we sent recruitment teams all over the East Coast. And we succeeded, I think, in getting a lot of good teachers who enjoyed teaching, enjoyed Harford County. We had a good salary. It wasn't the best, it wasn't the bottom, but we put high emphasis on salaries, at the expense of other things. Sometimes we didn't buy the books we needed because we wanted to pay good salaries and good benefits. So one of the highlights of my time was to be sure that teachers got adequate raises. Some years we succeeded, some years we didn't, but generally speaking, I think we held our own in terms of the competition. That was a significant event in my efforts to do. The other part of it was to see that the children were learning. I spent a lot of my time visiting schools to make sure that those good teachers that we hired were doing an effective job. And I would go in and out of classrooms more than most superintendents and enjoy doing it because I got to be familiar with the staff and they began, I think, to appreciate what I was doing. There were a lot of bumps in the road and at times when the frustration level was high. Oftentimes you'd get board members that were, playing to the orchestra, so to speak, wanting to grind an axe. Well, you'd have to deal with that problem. You'd have to dismiss teachers. Teachers, no matter how hard you tried, would eventually either get into trouble or otherwise get involved with some mess of some of the problems in our society, and you'd have to deal with discharges, this and that and the other. One problem that I encountered that most superintendents don't have to deal with, at least those in Maryland, and that was the teacher's strike. We had the second strike ever in the state of Maryland, even though it was illegal. Baltimore City had some kind of a job action at one time, but our strike lasted 4 days, and the strike wasn't attributed to me or my board at the time. It was attributed to the lethargy of the politician that was the county council at the time. Believe it or not, the guy that created that problem ended up being one of the best county executives that we had, and he learned his lesson the hard way, but he turned out to be a good county executive.
And that was Hayburn Freeman.
Yep, it certainly was, and he's one of my best friends these days, but we fell out on the strike.
Well, that's interesting, because that's the next thing I wanted to ask you about was that as superintendent of schools, I've always had the responsibility to work with the county executive, or before that it would have been the county commissioners,
right,
and the county council, to get the funds that you needed. What do you recall about some of the challenges and some of the personalities of some of the councils and commissioners that you had to deal with?
Well, we had to deal with politicians from all levels. It could be the state level, it would be the county level. Sometimes you'd have to deal with the people in the towns. And believe it or not, ultimately, you go to the federal level. I remember going to testify before a congressional committee on the importance of the Aberdeen Proving Ground to the school system. We got a lot of money from the federal government because we educated military children. And that could have been up to as high as $2.5 to $3 million a year. And that helped the county a lot, because if I didn't get it from the feds, we'd have to get it from the county. So we dealt with politicians. Now, the people at the federal level were not the kind that you had to browbeat to get the money. You went up and testified. But you'd have to go to state level, because the state was subsidizing school construction to a high level, and you'd always have to go there and deal with bureaucracy. And sometimes you'd get knocked down, and then you'd have to pull yourself together and get back up to the fight. And invariably, you'd go to Annapolis and you'd testify and you'd beg and try to get up to see the light. And I was reasonably successful in getting money from the state for building schools and for other needs. My biggest problem was dealing with the turnover in the county council. During 18 years, you saw the county council flip around, and I don't know how many there were, but there was a significant number of personalities, and they too were the kind that liked to grind an axe and liked to kick the superintendent of schools around. I remember one of them that was very much in the art of kicking the superintendent around. He was going to have us close schools when we had a modest decline, and he was pressing pretty hard for the closure of schools, and I said, fine, the first school I'm going to close is Churchville Elementary School. Churchville Elementary School is where his mother and wife taught. His name is Ed Fielder. He backed away very quickly, and do you know, to this day, it sounds strange, but he left the county council not on his own behalf, but he was voted out. He's now a teacher at the Hartford Vocational School. But there were personalities such as Mr. Fielder that always wanted to usurp the authority of the superintendent. I remember threatening the budget with this, that, or the other. One of my favorites is one of my former students. His name was Senator Arthur Helton. Arthur Helton was on the county council for several years, and one year I got successful in getting funding for building a new administration building, which was one of my, well, pet projects. The next year, he came by, and he was able to get the council to change their vote and to kill the program. Art Helton, as I said, at that time was a councilman, and he was one of my former students. And I taught him chemistry and physics, as I recall. He got elected to the Senate of the state of Maryland, representing Hartford, and I recall going to visit one day, and I was up in the balcony of the Senate chamber, and he took personal privilege of introducing me, and I thought that was kind of strange. Often happens if you go there. Anyhow, his introduction was, I want to introduce Superintendent Harford County Schools. And he gave me my name and so on, and he said, he was my teacher at one time. He said, today, however, the shoe is on the other foot. I'm the teacher. And that set me back pretty well. That was an event that isn't worth repeating much, but the fact is, you had all kinds of personalities with which to deal, and politics in the community, in Harford County, in the county level, is pretty vicious stuff. In many cases, upset me because politicians are here today and gone tomorrow, like board members, here today and gone tomorrow. But the career educator is here for 18 years, 20 years, 25 years. They still have to manage the store after the damage has been done. Spoke to you about Mr. Fielder. Mr. Fielder cut our budget one year so severely that I had to take most of the instructional supervisors, whom he, his mother, and wife did not like, and demote them for one year until I could get back on track. And that was an example of a guy here today, going tomorrow, and what does he do? He joins the troops. And why did he join the troops? For the salary and benefits that I preserved over the years. That's a long story.
That's an interesting story. That is a very interesting story.
Yeah.
Were there any particular elected leaders that stood out in your mind as being very strong advocates and really seeing a bigger picture? Anybody come to mind?
There were. In terms of the local level, the county council, there were people like John Hardwick, who was a pretty astute president of the council. There was John O'Neill, who was a member of the council and also a former county commissioner, who was strongly in favor of education. There was Hayburn Freeman, who ultimately came full circle. And John Schaefer was another good leader. At the state level, I enjoyed most Senator William S. James. Enjoyed him so much that I strongly advocated naming a school for him, which we were successful in doing. Bill James had many offices at the state level. The right person. His children went to the public schools. They were very successful in the public schools, and he always called, always stopped by to visit, always wanted to be sure that I didn't have overwhelming problems that I couldn't solve. And of course, he became very famous through his efforts as the president of the Senate and for developing the community college movement. He was very much interested in the vocational tech center that we built. Just an outstanding person at the state level. Now, there were a couple others. I liked Governor Marvin Mandel, despite all of the problems he encountered. I knew him personally, he knew me, and we were able to converse about school system problems. On the other hand, I also had occasions to deal with William Donald Schaefer, who was like a bull in a china shop, arrogant, hard-headed, unbending soul. At the national level, I got along very well with Senator Sarbanes, who was always looking out for our federal money, and Barbara Mikulski. Good people that were very much favoring public education, public schools. So there's an array of them, but those are the ones I think at the moment as being the significant ones.
Good. Now, before I leave this whole topic, I want to ask you one more thing about that administrative building. Because right now, Harford County Public Schools is in a very old building, headquartered, but they're in many buildings. Tell us what you thought about that many years ago.
I like to talk about that topic because it is one that I was not able to succeed in achieving, but I still am a strong believer that somebody ought to do something about it. But nonetheless, in the latter part of the 60s, I believe, Dr. Willis, my predecessor, decided that we needed to find a new site and a location for a new administration building. Other school systems in the state were doing that, instead of going to an old closed school and spending a lot of money on it, as we did here in Harford County in the early 50s, under the present facility. It was his intention that we work hard to get a new building. He was able to buy a site for the building, and the site is located currently where at the present time, where a Ring Factory Elementary School is located. That site was put in our, quote, site bank for future use for an administration building. As Dr. Willis retired, there was no success up until he retired. I took over and began to pursue it with diligence. And every year during my 18-year career, there was an item in the budget, the capital budget, suggesting or requesting funds for the administration building. Unfortunately, it met with a lot of resistance because at the time we were needing to build capacity projects for the school system, classrooms that is, and people were reluctant to get involved with spending money on building an administration building, even though most of them admitted, most of the elected officials admitted that we needed a new facility. As you have mentioned, during my entire tenure, we had staff members located in four or five different locations. I got so desperate that I began looking for rental space and found some space right on Main Street in Bel Air, and with reluctance, I decided to rent a facility there to house some of our central office personnel. The one thing that I found most difficult in my time was dealing with the dispersal of staff. We had a maintenance facility and a transportation facility and a school construction facility, all located up at Hickory. I was able to buy a warehouse to house the purchasing department, the school lunch department, the printing department up in Forest Hill. We occupied a couple of houses on Gordon Street that were later torn down. Nonetheless, we had a staff that was dispersed. It was difficult for me as a superintendent to communicate with them, to oversee their operations, and to be sure people were about the business of carrying on their responsibilities in an effective way. Anyhow, we pursued that objective frequently with the concurrence of members of the Board of Education who were very much upset with the facility that we were in. We had no elevators, we had no way for the handicapped people to get upstairs, and so forth, where the boardroom was located. So we had a lot of support from board members that were on the board from time to time. Incidentally, I dealt during my tenure with 28 different personalities on the school board, and every one of them supported the school administration building project. Many people in elective office, as well as those at the state level, supported the notion, but invariably, when it was time to vote on the issue, it was set aside. As I said earlier, it was set aside largely because we needed to build school facilities for children, and most people were reluctant to encourage spending money for an administration building, even though, generally speaking, they were supportive of it. Well, even today, I notice that there are people who are supporting the issue, The present administration has rented 3 or 4 storefronts on Main Street. I rented one. The irony of the situation is that with all the rental money that was spent in the last 25 years, that is 18 of mine and 7 of somebody else's, with that rental money, we could have amortized the bonds, had the building built, and be debt-free by this day. And unfortunately, there's going to be another 25 years passed before anybody even thinks of getting a school administration building. There's no strong advocacy for it now, and I think they're waiting for a time when they can probably take over an old school and spend millions on rehabilitating one so it can be used as an administration building. My thought at the moment is that they'll probably go to Aberdeen after the Aberdeen new high school facility is built, and probably take over the old Aberdeen North building, readapt it, and transfer the whole leadership team from Bel Air to Aberdeen. But that's just crystal ball gazing.
Now, the building we're currently, in 2001, talking about as the headquarters for the superintendent and his staff is an old school building, isn't it, Dr. Birdie?
It's the old Bel Air Elementary School. It's over 100 years old, except some recently added or additions that were put on it for computers and stuff like that. But it is archaic. As I said earlier, it has no elevators. As a matter of fact, it's so bad that the board doesn't meet there anymore. They rotate around to different schools, which in and of itself is not a good policy. You need to have a fixed location where people are aware of where the Board of Education meets. The matter of circulating around doesn't, to my way of thinking, doesn't suit.
Well, I want to ask you too, while you were superintendent, I know you were selected to go to the Soviet Union. Can you tell us how that came about and a little bit about what you saw when you got to the Soviet Union?
When I was selected by the then state superintendent of schools to be a representative of Maryland, I was a new superintendent of schools, and Dr. James Sensenbaugh was the state superintendent of schools. He recommended me as a candidate to U.S. Information Agency office to visit the schools in the Soviet Union. When I went there, I was naturally not too excited about what might be the case in Russia, but I wouldn't pass up the chance to go. A little weary, thinking, well, you might get in trouble and they might jail you or otherwise keep you for a long period of time. My wife was very much concerned. Nonetheless, I went with much interest and spent 21 days, I think, over in the Soviet Union, visiting a few schools, not many. They wouldn't let us visit very many. During that time, there were very difficult relationships between the United States and the Soviet Union. The dictators in the Soviet Union were not very amenable to compromise and working with the United States. So we had a lot of movement. They would move us at night by air so that we couldn't see too much. They guarded us regularly, day and night. They wouldn't allow us to move about much, even in Moscow. And we went to Outer Mongolia, and that's practically uncivilized. But it was quite an ordeal. It was cold, snowy. Hotel accommodations were pretty lousy. Not much to say about their food. And certainly, we didn't get much freedom. We didn't get to see a whole lot except governmental sites. We toured a lot in Moscow. We went to the Kremlin. We went to see Lenin's tomb. We went to Under Guard. We went to the Gom department store. We went to St. Petersburg, and although that was a New York City type city, it was difficult for us to see very much. It was an experience I'll never forget, but it was not with a great deal of freedom that we were able to move about. We had an interesting affair. We were out at a town called Irkutsk, out in Outer Mongolia. And I think they were trying us out. They had young ladies calling our rooms, offering to meet with us. for various and sundry purposes. And I was afraid that that they were trying to trap us. That was one of the game plans that they had.
That's interesting. Now, what year was that, Dr. Birdie?
It was about 1973.
So the Cold War mentality was still very strong there, wasn't it? What did you notice about the schools that they did take you to? Was there anything that stood out?
We went to visit with Yuri Gagarin's teacher. He was the first guy into space. And the seats were like ours were in the 1800s. Rows nailed to the floor. Wooden throughout. Dark, dingy, unfinished. Sort of like old schools in West Virginia when they wanted to do something, they oiled the floors, fireplaces and coal burning stoves. It was pretty sad and inadequate materials, but they evidently got along pretty well. Children were poorly dressed. There wasn't much in that society that was good. It was just a terrible kind of and it was Russia in its truest form. I mean, so we went to almost every province. Had a lot to see, but it was restricted and under guard.
Right.
And today, I think you move about much more freely. It wasn't, of course, I got shingles before I got home, and that was the sad part of it. I stood around with shingles for months.
Mm. Wow.
So cold.
And food, as you said, was probably pretty bland, was it?
Yeah. Well,
or was that a good day if it was bland?
Yeah, well, yeah, that was. But you got vodka. Occasionally,
mm-hmm.
And borscht, which was a cabbage kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of raw fish, stuff like that. You couldn't get a steak to save you.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you just didn't eat. And you wouldn't drink their water either. You know, it was just awful. But they'd have bottled water occasionally, but you didn't have enough, a lot of money, so you didn't buy that stuff either. You just limped along.
Well, next question I want to ask you, you have, I think, answered parts of, but I'm going to ask you again, just to say it. I know we all probably have role models and mentors in our lives. Who would you say was yours?
Well, I'd have to give most of the credit to Dr. Lewis. He just was an amazing person. I remember walking down the boardwalk in Atlantic City with him, and I had just come into the central office, and I think I was at the time, I was probably early 30s, and he looked at me and he said, "Boy, to be your age, that'd be wonderful, wouldn't it? And to be where you are in this school system is something I don't understand."
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the guy that put me there. And he was just, he was rough around the edges. People were afraid of him. He had a big stature, and he always had a grumpy look on his face. But when you got to know him, he was the most pleasant soul. Yet people were afraid of him. They'd see him coming, they'd think, "Oh my God, look at that. He's going to chew somebody out or race game." But he really was a nice person. And when you got to know him, you admired him. And he was a particularly good teacher. And I enjoyed him very much. I had a lot of good exposure to people in the military, people there that I admired as well. But they were not school administrators, they were just leaders. And I got a bit of my leadership skill, if I had any at all, from observing company commanders, platoon sergeants, and people in the military that were just good leaders. And that's what it takes. You don't need to know a lot, you need to know how to assemble a team of people that will do your work for you. I learned that early on from the American Management Association, and that's how I got the good people that I could get to manage the store. And you have certain checkpoints that you watch effectively let them run their store,
mm-hmm.
and it does a good job that way.
Well, as you look back at Harford County, what changes have you seen that you feel have been good for the county? And maybe what changes have you seen that may not be so good?
Well, the growth problem bothers all of us. The great number of townhouses, the traffic congestion, all of that bothers us significantly. It was inevitable in this nice area close to Baltimore, between Baltimore, Wilmington, and Philadelphia, near Washington. I think that if I had my druthers, I would prefer to have it like it was when I came here. And we would not have such drastic growth in the school system. We would not have the traffic snarls and all of the stoplights when I came here. And we were lucky to see one stoplight. Well, we got them everywhere today. I guess I would like to see it back like it was, but that's a pipe dream. I don't think it was in the cards. I find what we have today is exciting, and it's interesting. I often wondered if Dr. Willis could come back today and see what we got, what his first impression would be. His first impression would naturally be, how in the world did they let this happen? Well, it happened through good government or bad government or whatever it was, but I think it was inevitable. You can't be 23 miles away from Baltimore City and not have the growth like we have, Carroll County and Howard County and all the suburban counties. There is some good to be said about it. It's exciting because you see a lot of opportunity for young people, a lot of opportunity for people in general. There are a lot of jobs. There's a lot to be accomplished in the county. But it certainly would be better, I think, if it wasn't so impacted with the growth. Everywhere you go, there's a stoplight. Everywhere you go, they're building a house or a warehouse. It doesn't make any difference whether you go to Aberdeen or Havertagrass, along Route 40. The only place that's still sort of partially green is North Hartford area. But the housing is there as well. It's just that people have larger lots. So I, on the one hand, am chagrined by the rapidity and the growth and the congestion. On the other hand, I see some positive values in it.
Very good. Well, I'm going to ask you a crystal ball question now. Do you have any thoughts on what the educational system of the future is going to be like?
I think it's going to be pretty much like it is. You and I have lived through several years of watching the school system. Now, if you talk about the clientele and people being served, that's another story. But I think, aside from a little bit more in the technological arena, the schools will pretty much be teaching English, social studies, mathematics, and science. And hopefully they'll broaden the curriculum maybe in some way to deal with ongoing problems. We deal now with drug education, smoking, health problems. I hope that they continue to do the kind of things that they're doing today. And frankly, I know people will say, well, it's going to be different. Well, you look back over time and you find that we're doing pretty much what we did then, the last century. Again, there are no typewriters anymore. Technology has moved in. They're probably not teaching shorthand anymore. But in general, the basics are going to be there now from time immemorial. I think you've got to have good teaching. You're not going to do it with television. You're not going to do it all with computers. You're going to do some of it, but you've got to have the basics. And I think the future is going to be somewhat the same as it is now, excepting technological advancements that will put a few more, maybe computers of a different sort. Maybe the audio-visual aspects will change somewhat because they'll probably use a lot more discs. I think that's an image, but I still maintain. I remember when television came along, cable TV and all that, they thought, well, they're going to displace teachers. They're going to do a lot. And I even had a couple of people challenge me, why don't you grab hold of this TV thing, save money by getting rid of some teachers? I just look at them and laugh. If you don't do it, it's not going to happen. It's going to be pretty much like it is, I think.
Dr. Roberti, thank you so much for giving us your information about your life and about what it was like to be a school system superintendent. We thank you very much for that, and we thank you for all the accomplishments that you have made over the years to make Harford County an excellent school system. And any successes that we're seeing today, I think, can be traced back to your time period. Thank you so much.
Thank you.